Intracerebral hemorrhage is still a major obstacle in stroke care, currently undergoing extensive international research. I'm Ashlyn Grimley on work experience here at the Journal of Stroke, and I'll be joining Carmen to speak with one of the major contributors in this area, young stroke professional Dr. Dar Dawlatshahi.
Excellent, thank you. So I'm Dar Dawlatshahi, the stroke neurologist at the Ottawa Hospital in Ottawa, Ontario, Canada. And I'm an assistant professor at the University of Ottawa and a scientist at the Ottawa Hospital Research Institute.
Why did you start doing research?
I guess I was interested in research since back when I was an undergrad. I was very interested in figuring out where information came from, how it is that it got into our textbooks, and that got me asking some questions and ultimately meeting up with my mentors to pursue a PhD. And I was fascinated by the brain at a very young point, again, while I was in my undergraduate, actually probably even before the undergraduate years. And so that opportunity to do research in neuroscience was very compelling, and it was just, I guess it was just felt like a natural thing to do.
Why did you go into stroke?
Well, after starting a PhD in neuroscience, I got interested in clinical medicine, mostly, again, due to my mentor, who was a clinician scientist. So when I went into medical training, neurology appealed to me. It was very natural for me because I'd already been doing research in the neurosciences, so I was a natural fit. And once I got into neurology, the first place that jumped out at me was stroke. It was the action field. It sort of provides both that high-intensity, high-stakes action emergency care, but also in the context of the brain. So you get to satisfy sort of an intellectual academic side of you, but you also get to see a lot of action and save lives.
Great. So where have you worked?
I've worked in Hamilton. I did Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, now known as the Population Health Research Institute is there. That's where I did my clinical training and my PhD, and that's affiliated with McMaster University. And then I spent many years doing my residency in Ottawa here. And then I left here to go to Calgary, which is on the other side of Canada, Calgary, Alberta, and that's the home of the Calgary Stroke Program. Very high-intensity training there, and that's where I got my stroke specialization, and then I came back and settled here in Ottawa.
Okay, so in that time, have you had any memorable mentors?
A key mentor would be Andrew Demchuk over at the Calgary Stroke Program. I met him early on while I was doing my neurology training here in Ottawa, and I'd already been reading a lot of his work. He was at the time doing a lot of transcranial Doppler work and looking at recanalization rates. So I was very, very familiar with his work when I did meet him, and that provided an excellent opportunity to go train further. And then along with Andrew, who's been and continues to be a great mentor to me, I also met the other collaborators over at Calgary, Sheila Coots, who's very well known for her work in TIA and minor stroke, and of course Michael Hill, very famous trialist, and also one of the PIs of the recent ESCAPE endovascular trial. So I got to work with all three of them quite closely and still continue to collaborate. I definitely list them as key influences and supporters for many years.
Okay, so in that field, it's obviously quite difficult to balance work life and home life. How do you find that?
It's an ongoing struggle. It's very easy to immerse yourself in the academic and the clinical side at the expense of your home life. So there's been a few strategies. I mean, one, I really try and keep the work at work where possible, and then during the hours when I get home, have dinner, just to make sort of dedicated time with my kids and my wife. Can try and keep the iPhone off. That's kind of important. It's hard to do, but you do your best. And once the kids are in bed, if I need to catch up a little bit of email, do it there. But basically, that's the key, is to just make sure you can draw some very hard, firm lines. The other thing that's critical is to be working with others, collaborating, and to have very good people around you who can take over some of the responsibilities at different times. And I have some excellent academic collaborators, and we kind of go back and forth where I'll cover some of their work for them at times so they can have more family time and whatnot, as well as personnel, research personnel, who you feel very comfortable delegating and stepping away from certain tasks so that you're not just consumed. But it is truly a constant struggle. There's no question about that.
What are your hobbies?
Gosh, that's good. I guess me and my kids and my wife, we like to get outside when we can. So we enjoy certainly hiking, and camping is big around here. Winter, of course, the skiing and the snowshoeing. My boys and I, we like watching movies. So we do the movies. My boy's right here right now. He's telling me ice skating. So we'll be doing some of that very soon. I still play the drums, not as much as I'd like to, but music has been something that I've always done as a hobby. And I enjoy some Canadian football, which is a little bit different than actually, it's quite similar to Australian football, I must say, but different than European football. But that too.
What sort of international collaborations have you established? How have you built those?
When I was doing my fellowship with Andrew Demchak, it was a very important thing he told me at that time. He told me I need to start setting some flyers during my fellowship and then spend the rest of my career putting those flyers out once they get out of control. And that's exactly what we did. Those flyers were the seeds of these collaborations. Essentially, he had a very open attitude with me going out, meeting people, trying to strike up projects very early on. And I was able to set up some national and some very early international collaborations. Did some work through the Vista Archives, which we're still continuing to do. Quite a bit of work on the large international cerebral hemorrhage study called PREDICT, which that's across six countries. So that kind of created six contacts and then sub-studies with all those people. As those projects grew, you then bump into colleagues who are out there doing similar work as you, and then that would open up another opportunity for collaboration. So after a couple of years of fellowship and getting things started, 5 years later, I've maintained these networks. A lot of them have sort of overlapped and grown dramatically, and now it's more of an issue, as Andrew predicted, of putting out the fires, trying to complete the collaborations and trying to complete the studies, spinning off the next ones, and so on and so forth. So I do think these collaborations are fantastic, because we really can't survive in a vacuum. And certainly when you're dealing with diseases of a slightly lower incidence like cerebral hemorrhage, you really need to have these larger networks to be able to capture sufficient patients in a short period of time to be able to execute the studies.
In terms of just sort of people coming into the field, Dara, or people who are looking at the sort of career path that you've had, what would you advise them were your most dynamic collaborations, and how did you kind of kick those off?
I think the key is, first of all, find out what you really want to do. Because the biggest mistake one can make is to go off in a direction where they're not particularly interested in that science, but it just happens to be an opportunity. You want to really go, what is it you want to do, so that you know that you're invested in it. The second thing is, I would say you have to be very open and honest. And in academia, as with any other field, there can be some difficult personalities. It's important not to be one of those difficult personalities. It's important to be open, honest, collaborative. That does mean that you put yourself at times at risk. There is always that potential that someone will scoop you, or someone will have intentions that are not necessarily in the best interest of the science, but that's okay. I think you just need to put that aside and move forward. So I definitely say taking the honest approach, being open, sharing the data, big believer in sharing data, not holding it, locking it up, secreting it. As one of my mentors told me, there's enough water out there to float everybody's boat. So if you focus on the big goal, which is advancing that science that you're interested in, everything else should fall into place.
Great. So more specifically, what kind of impact do you want to have on stroke care?
I'd like to be part of the group that comes up with a treatment for cerebral hemorrhage.
Are there any new aspects in research that you hope to explore?
One area that I've always been faced with is the nihilism surrounding cerebral hemorrhage, particularly as we get more and more treatments for ischemic stroke. And it's absolutely fantastic to be clinically part of the ischemic stroke struggle, and seeing patients get up and walk away, it's absolutely fantastic. Paradoxically, you see the opposite in cerebral hemorrhage. And that's where I think it's just such a fantastic opportunity to influence both the way that we can triage our patients, detect which ones are at the highest risk, and develop the treatments, different treatments for different forms of bleeds at different stages of the hemorrhage. The other area that I've gotten interested in is also some of the recovery work that's been going on, the rehabilitation work. I think that there's been quite a bit of a shift in that direction because we're doing so well acutely that now we want to kind of expand our armament from the first 3 months and then so on and so forth. So I'm very interested in seeing what comes of some of these regenerative types of studies that are going on all over the world. It's very, very early, but very promising, I think. What I find really interesting is that you can get up at, say, 3 in the morning, run in and do some absolutely crazy therapeutic run, get yourself back home 2-3 hours later, having literally saved someone's life, and that person could do so well that they go home the next day. And in that situation, although you yourself realize the massive impact that you had, it's kind of forgotten. Nobody remembers you, and it's not about that anyway. So it kind of just sort of happens in the middle of the night, and then it passes. But then on another day, when you're doing something that in your mind might be routine, such as simply chatting with someone in a palliative situation, an elderly person, big stroke, it's not going to go well, it's game over. And really, in your mind, you didn't need 20 years of training to be able to do what you're doing here. You just needed a little bit of humanity. And you have a chat with the family, and you hug, and then you go home, and you forget about it. And then 3-4 weeks later, you get a letter coming in the mail, and you suddenly realize that you had to that family and to the children of that family, you probably had equal or more of an effect, even though you didn't feel you did much. And then there's the sort of unstated effect afterwards of you being seen as a role model, possibly by the children that are in that room, for example. And then maybe they go on and go into research, or maybe they go on and become clinicians, and so on and so forth. So I guess the epiphany is how you don't really know the impact that you have.
You've just been listening to a podcast interview with young stroke professional Dar Dulat Shahi for the International Journal of Stroke. The International Journal of Stroke is the flagship publication of the World Stroke Organization. Please consider becoming a member to contribute to reducing the burden of stroke worldwide.